my poems have the madness in them. I could be mad, I could be crazy, I can be wild, I don't have to give a fuck. And I think that's like in some ways what his absence taught me.
Welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast, where we talk not only about writing, but literary nonprofits, small press publishing, philosophy, psychology, all through the lens of poetry. I'm Bianca Stone, and today I'm so happy to be talking with the poet Arisa White.
Arisa.
Oh my God. After reading that part in your book about pronouncing your name, it still didn't settle it for me, but I was like, because I say Marisa, and I think you said something about the name Marisa. I'd say Marisa.
No, it's... Wait, the whole thing with the names, it's my mom wanted to name me Melissa.
That's right, Melissa.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought it was Arisa.
Yeah, but it's spelled like Lisa, though.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm winning today.
You totally are.
Arisa White is a Cave Canem Fellow, an assistant professor of creative writing at Colby College, and is the author of 4 books, including the poetry collection You're the Most Beautiful Thing That Happened, and co-author of Biddy Mason Speaks Up. And today we're talking with her about her incredible new book, Who's Your Daddy? A lyrical, genre-bending, coming-of-age tale featuring a queer, Black, Guyanese-American woman who, while seeking to define her own place in the world, negotiates an estranged relationship with her father. And it's out now from Augury Books. And Arisa, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Bianca.
Yay. So, Who's Your Daddy is truly a phenomenal book. I haven't felt this excited about reading a book beginning to end in a long time. It's really different before you even open it, knowing that you've deliberately put it into the genre of memoir as well as poetry. So I thought we could start off just talking a little bit about your decision to do that. And this idea of genre bending in the poetry world and how that form fit with this subject matter.
I this book came out of really such a very, very much a lived experience. So it's in the sense that as I was writing it, I was doing it, you know what I mean? And, because it started with my mom asking me if I wanted to write my father, Gerald, in Guyana. And I didn't know what I was going to write. Yeah. So,
wow, she asked you.
Yeah, she asked me. So this book was very much prompted by that question of, do you want to write your father? And I was like, who's my father? Yeah. but really in asking sort of who's my father, I was really more so asking like, what do I share with him? So it was this question of who am I? And which parts of myself am I going to share with him? Mm. And so that just became this exercise in sharing everything, just kind of keeping a notebook, a journal. I was writing epistolary poems just because that just made sense. Okay. And right there already we're beginning to blend genres. So the work already starts in this place of the blended. So
talk about the term epistolary poetry.
So it's poems that are written like letters. So you address it to someone. And so I just thought that was the perfect form to work in because I was preparing myself to write an actual letter. And so I was also employing sort of documentary poetics just finding this different registers of voice to enter into. So you enter into that epistolary mode of Dear Gerald, you know, right, and this right. sort of beginning to hear these echoes of the Victorian and this sort of romantic image of myself writing by candlelight.
Right.
As well as just thinking about how to even address him. So there was at one point I had this poem that was mostly about like how to begin a letter. So I'd be like, Dear Gerald, lowercase d, dear dad, dear daddy, dear D-O-G. Like it was just like all of these ways of figuring out how to like what to call him.
Yeah.
And then also just spending time, you know, talking about going to the chiropractor, sort of introducing him to my wife. Wasn't my wife at the time, like my girlfriend, and thinking about, you know, what do I share with him and what do I open up to? And what I realized is that at this point in my life, I didn't have to hide anything. So I can just sort of be like open in all parts of who I was and not even feel this sense of, I have to hide the fact that I'm a lesbian as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, even though the Caribbean is known for not being kind and welcoming to the LGBT community. So right there, beginning at that place of like, these are all my parts and nothing, I don't need to sort of like come out to you. There's no sort of evolving self. What I have is an evolved self.
Right. You get the sense like when you do see her meeting him that she's just more, he seems more the tragic figure who doesn't have it together. You know, and she's in this place of like also trying to figure out like, I don't owe you anything. And even like he's even seems in this place where he's expecting things from her, almost as if she's the parent too. So it's like this weird, like it's interesting to think about all that you prepared in meeting him, because you just don't know how he's gonna be, right?
I definitely don't at all. I mean, everything has, you know, by that point, I just heard stories of him. And so he was just this mythological figure, as well as a kind of ghosted sort of shadowy figure in my own life memory as well. Mm-hmm. So I was able to work with absence and ghosting and a kind of disappearance in these really interesting and creative ways.
That's so cool, because I, you know, it's true that memory in general, there's so much absence in it, that you get that is explored in poetry, and poetry is the place of ambiguity, right? It's the place of negative capability. So it's really the perfect place for something like memoir. I mean, poetry is in a way is more memoir, of course, than fiction would ever be. Because it's dealing so much with the self, with the true experience, with the truth. So, you know, but doubly not knowing the father, I too didn't know my father till I was older. And, you know, there's so much ambiguity there in your own identity. And like, and especially I love the mother in this book too. Just the little we get of her, it feels so familiar between them. And of course, like here you have this person that you just couldn't be more intimate with in a way. Although there's so much they don't know that you don't share with them too. But like, and then meeting this person who knows nothing about you and you have nothing to bounce off of except for what you've heard through her. And like,
And then meeting my father, that's what I began to recognize, is that the only thing I have is really the bits of their relationship and the sort of love that they had at the time that they were together. Because one of the things that my mom would say was like, I really loved Gerald. Like, you know, like you came out of love, you know, and there's always this sweet energy, emanating from her whenever she sort of speaks of him. You know, there's a tenderness that becomes really present in her storytelling. And so in some ways, I think I wanted to honor that tenderness as well as I was confronting a person who was, you know, who is like pretty narcissistic. Yeah. So it's like, you know, in some ways, what it winds up playing into is the ways in which I developed that, the water imagery, and made it into a motif so that I am this kind of body of water for narcissists in a way. But then also it transmutes and transfigures. So
absolutely. I mean, you completely transmuted it by the end. I mean, I thought it was the most generous moment in the world. Like, oh my God, I'm like gonna cry. It felt very empathetic and powerful, and just bigger than that small narcissism, you know. It completely went above it.
Yeah, and just also thinking like in that moment of, you know, even sort of going through my 30s and my Saturn return and just everything feeling like it's falling apart, those narratives that I built myself upon, or the right. stories I told myself, were all crumbling because they were no longer working or helping me to align with my own purpose. And so what I got to learn is to kind of confront those hard, dark, and difficult parts of me, the ways in which I'm a narcissist, an asshole, or a jerk, the ways in which I don't show up. So it's like recognizing that our relationships are these ways in which we can potentiate ourselves, that by being in relationship, we have these, we just hit up against our difficult parts and can sort of rub them down and smooth them out and let the crust come off so that something more polished and more available to us is seen and can be held. And I think, you know, what became so fulfilling is being able to make myself into a character that was fluid, that was very much like based on my passions for astronomy and astrology and things of the sort. And what I realized, like in making this book and also in having this kind of personal task of writing my father, is that I became more comfortable with my parts. Like I began to welcome in the sort of like things that I would call flaws or people would sort of notice and kind of want me to correct. I welcomed all of those pieces as really material, as ways to structure and create a unique kind of author, like an authentic kind of storytelling that has my broken Creole, that has the ways in which my subject verbs don't agree, which can carry my music and the sort of odd ways I look at the world. And totally. And it's almost the permission that I got from Gerald to sort of write his stories, as well as telling me my poems have the madness in them. I could be mad. I could be crazy. I can be wild. I don't have to give a fuck. And I think that's like, in some ways, what his absence taught me is that be you, do you, prioritize you. Mm-hmm. Prioritize you even to the point that like you will ask other people to tend to you even if you haven't tended to them, you know. It's like that kind of self-possession is just incredible.
I mean, you credit Gerald, but you've done this work. I mean, you've done this work to come to this place and created something out of it and grown as a person and completely transformed. I mean, it's like all we can hope is that we have that kind of journey in putting together a manuscript to be a book. It's like, that's the level we're working at. Like, it's not just like, oh, put these poems together. This one looks good with this one. This is a fun idea. It's like, holy shit. Like, you've transformed, and honoring all those different parts of yourself, I think that's really what came through in this book to me, is that there was a certain amount of like raw honesty, and honoring of the sort of the duality, the falseness of duality, the sort of the unity of opposites. This always ends up coming up in the episodes, but like that felt so human to me, and I felt so let into the book through that, and I felt like I was on this journey with you. And it's not a small thing. Like, it's actually a huge feat in a single poem, let alone a whole book. Would you read a poem from the book?
Do you have a desire?
I have desires. I sure do.
Okay.
I feel like should we start with one from the beginning? The one I really definitely want you to read is the 61. My therapist says is the.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's something you said where it's like, I did the work, but I also have to credit, the work was like within a matrix of people, like a web of people. Yeah. Like there's something about the journey of this book that made me shift my eye, the narrative eye even as well, from like a navel gazing one to a communal eye. And it's even, you can also feel that in the way in which I bring in other source materials and quotes and the oracle that is my mother. Like, it's because there was something about this particular point in my life where I needed other people to help me fill the absence of this story, to fill the absence of my father, and therefore the absences I was feeling in myself. So yeah, I totally went on the quest, but I did it with a really strong sense of presence at my back to support and comfort me, and also push me and make it uncomfortable, so that I can recalibrate and find different ways of standing tall, even when the room is crooked and the ground is shaking. So I'll start with like the, my mother is 19.
Okay.
My mother is 19 when she meets Gerald. Handsome, tall, good, healthy teeth, dressed sharp and debonair, he could steal the room. She felt lucky he chose her. 10 years her senior, and she smiles, mostly to herself, remembering him teaching her how to drive. All the places she goes, in his Cadillac down Fulton Street, down Nostrand Ave, without question up and down Atlantic and Pacific, DeKalb on Eastern Parkway, through gates in Myrtle, Bushwick and Halsey, sunsets on Jay. Down this first day of spring, red lights every 2 minutes when contractions start. The cab ride stretches out before the hospital. I am her second child. She has calm nerves, clear expectations, controlled breath, an easy birth. And what she negotiated with Gerald, a married man, about his role in my care, definitely included a one-way street. Shall I read 61?
Please.
Okay. My therapist says, we attract the people who are going to help us heal what we came to heal in this lifetime. It is convenient for Monday Way to label me the cheater and not claim her role, the one willing to pursue another in a relationship, to court with jewelry and time. This is the cruelty of her honesty.
She doesn't reveal herself in the process, doesn't allow her vulnerability to be here with me. She doesn't care for my dignity, for the presence of esteem. In her assessment of my character, so causal and very little spiral, she's asking for a death, but she is no wake to celebrate its homegoing. More executioner than I'm willing to offer my neck. I exist within a cosmology of experiences. Her critiques supported by her routines, standards, and worldview, volleying between two poles of right and wrong that don't serve nobody, causing harm and founts of resentment. There's a soluble line between love and hate. Without dignity, I'm naked before a crowd. I reinstate walls to defend. Without dignity, I can't hear another's truth. My body is tuned to the ring shout of voices saying, "You're the beauty your ancestors dream." I self-preserve. I don't show mine if you don't show yours. Our desires are made in our entire image. I fooled myself into expecting my desire to take a shape holier than I. Come to find out, every grown-ass woman has her grown-ass girl. Monday way occasions what default behavior looks like. It is so unkind and unloving to yourself and others because you've subsumed an authentic part of yourself to activate it. Reduce the other person to some triggering trope, and so both parties go missing in the exchange. I see this in myself now.
Just everything you were speaking about is here in this poem. I just, you know, I appreciate the partner that comes on this journey with you in this book, and the complexities of the relationship that we get to see as well.
And I think that came, like, that was one of the, that was, okay, that's like one of the major edits that my editor sort of, like, the creation of Monday Way and the Rios was the result of my editor saying, there are too many names. She is like, I'm getting lost. Uh-huh. There's this person, and then this relationship, and then this, and then it, because I wanted this way to kind of reflect on these different romantic, intimate partnerships that really pushed me in these deep and sometimes unsettling and beautifying ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so my editor's like, it's great, but we need to, like, you kind of need to figure out how to not confuse the reader in so many kind of timelines and relationships. And so because I essentially like wrote the last section of this book first, because it was the experience of going to Guyana and kind of that journey of getting there that felt like the pulse for me. So I started there. And then my editor was like, how did you get there? Which is like the development of childhood and sort of adolescence and young adulthood. And so because I learned in my research that Guyana and Arawak translates to the land of many waters, that became the way in which I began to develop the narrator. I was like, how is she going to get to the land of many waters? So she's going to be a Pisces. So therefore she's going to be a fish. And then with these relationships, I was like, romantic, intimate others, they are going to become the rivers. So there's this sort of composite, they're a composite character, and so is Monday Way. And so sort of pulling out these different kind of pivotal moments in my intimate relationships to kind of move me towards the land of many waters.
You know, and people take note here, if, you know, trying to tell a story, like you have to make those kind of decisions and not worry about, but that's what fiction writers do. I have to be like completely wedded to the truth and everything has to be exactly, everybody's got to have a name and it's got to be the right location and everything's like, fuck that. Like you got to write a good book too, you know? And
yeah.
And also that's where the play comes in.
Exactly. Like, I so needed that play. Yeah. Like it was so fun for me to play in this whole thing.
And it opened up all these other implications.
Mm-hmm. It really did. And that was sort of like the fun and the joy, you know, like whenever I would hand it over to my editor, she's like, this is great. Because the first draft with that kind of closing scene of the ceremony and the ABCs, I was like, oh my fucking God, what have I done? And I'm about to hand this over to someone. And so I was really self-conscious about it, but something about it was just so lively and I felt intoxicated by the risk of it. Oh, and I handed it over to Kate Angus and she's like, this is beautiful, this is amazing. And so, and then I think from there I was like, whatever she tells me to do, I'll just do it.
Okay, another thing people should take note of is that your book becomes while you're working, while you, after you give it to your editor. So it's like, that's when the real stuff happens.
Yes.
Like, when they challenge you and you go and you like explode like that, mm-hmm. like that's when the book really comes together and people think it's the opposite, you know? Like,
yeah.
That's why it's essential to have an editor or someone to work with you on your book. Like you've got to have someone to like open those possibilities for you.
It's so true. And a lot, and you know, and her suggestions are always just these questions or, and it would be like, I think you should remove this section. She also like worked with me on You're the Most Beautiful Thing That Happened. And she would do the same thing. She's like, remove this section. And it's always, and I start to realize like the editing process becomes this like spiritual process, this moment of personal reflection, because what I realize what I'm holding on to is the dead matter, even in my own life. Oh, and so it's like,
so fucking true.
It's like, just,
and I
like,
just ripped it out and threw it in the trash, and I've never felt better.
Exactly.
And then you like inject it with like some serious, like crazy shit that you're the madness.
It's so true because it does come out of a kind of madness. Yeah. A part of me's a little bit pissed. I'm just like, you know how long I worked on that?
Oh, it's so true. Like, I'm like, that was an essential poem to the book. And I've been working on that poem for years. And then I'm like, I'm so pissed about it that I wrote like a 3-page like, bomb dropping poem. It's like, I'm like, oh, phew. Okay. You're right.
Exactly.
There's like one line left from the original poem. Like,
it's so true. Exactly. It's so true. Yeah. So I appreciate it as much as I am kind of, I get upset about it, but I remember she did like the last sort of time I handed her the manuscript, she's like, she pulled out like 20 pages her question suggested that I take home 20 pages and I spent like just my summer vacation from teaching, just working on it.
Wow. Like, yeah.
Oh my God. Gotta get it.
You know, and then you realize, well, you've got to do that work, even though that work may not show up in the book. Like it had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So read us another one. Maybe. Is there one that, I mean, the D-I-F-G-H-D-I-F-G on page 94 is great. Or maybe one of the, like, really near the end ones.
What about Sacrifice? The Sacrifice Zones, 97 or?
97? Yeah.
Or, totally. I'm like.
Oh, I love that.
Right. I haven't read that one really. Sacrifice zones are the places of social abandonment, where Americans are trapped in interminable cycles of poverty, powerlessness, and hopelessness as a direct result of changeable policies that enforce capitalistic greed and allow individuals, families, communities, and ecosystems to all be destroyed for quarterly profit. Am I a site of abandonment? Now cite the person who has abandoned you. Gerald says, the only father you got is God, the only one to cry out to, the only one who can hold your body. He has abandoned his part. He has abandoned himself. He has abandoned his semen. He has left the pudendum. A few months before this trip, I put out a call for letters because I was curious to know who else plays that guessing game of, is that him or where is he? 18 letters, far as the Philippines, some from inmates in San Quentin and poets from the Bay Area, written to fathers, to absent fathers, estranged and dead fathers, to their retreating back to that space left in their wake. These letters lighthouse the kinship of our suffering, our similar wanting, how we extend in the world and cannot explain that whole note in a state of oh, but never saying. Dear, a man who wasn't there, Anthony Lee Porchia, Raffi, Dad, American GI number one, Father, Floyd, Robert, Tennyson, whoever you are, my dad, my father, Dad slash Dennis, James Keith, sperm donor, who is Jeffrey, Mr. Midget Man, my dear pops, Ben. At one point, I thought to answer these letters and do the work the fathers couldn't or wouldn't do, but that's not my name.
There's so many things I love about the form of this poem on the page. First of all, I love how you put the quotes in this book. But they're, like you said before, these almost collaborative uses of quotes, putting them, this one's at the beginning, but some of them are in the middle of poems. Yeah. And then it almost feels like sometimes there's poems within the poem that are smaller. Then it turns and starts having a conversation with people, and you get the sense that this was really something that happened, that you really got these names.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that, what you did there.
Well, okay, so I applied for a grant from the Center for Cultural Innovation. She's based in Los Angeles. So by this time, I think it's been about 3 or so years or that I've been writing just epistolary poems, just going.
Yep.
And so I figured, oh, I have a project. Let me apply for a grant.
Yep.
And just sort of see what can come out of it. And you know, one of the great things about grants is that they're just like this time for dreaming, just like dreaming your project larger. And in doing that, it sort of opens up the possibilities of what else can happen, which becomes really exciting for me. And so when confronted with this grant, I was like, it would be kind of cool if I like self-published these epistolary poems into a little chapbook. And then I invited other people to tell me about their fathers. And then I go to Guyana and I meet my father. Like, woo.
Yeah.
And it happened. So it's like, okay, I gotta do this now. And so So I put out a call for letters, just sort of first electronically, and actually going through some old stuff, I realized like some students from a community college in the Bay, they wind up making a documentary response to my question of wow. folks kind of writing letters to their fathers. And it was three young women who were asking this question as well. And I was in the documentary, which is pretty cool. That's and awesome. I forgot about that. I forgot about that video that came out of that. And so they were able to do something for one of their classes at school, but also it connected to what they were thinking about deeply as young Black women in the world. And then people were sending me letters. I had a friend who was doing workshops at San Quentin. And so that became an opportunity for them to participate in this project. And so I worked with a designer and put the work all in the chapbook, which is called Dear Gerald. It was a limited edition chapbook. And I would exchange, this would be my sort of currency. So if you gave me a letter, I gave you a book. Oh, and wow. And I also held workshops. And so at those workshops, I would also hand out the books and I would then get letters in return. And it was great just to kind of have some material to work with. At first, like I said in the poem, I thought I was going to respond to them. Yeah. And then I was like,
that's like so much.
Yeah.
It was emotionally and just practically.
Yeah. I was like, that's too much. But I was kind of I was in this space where I was really blending theatrics and poetry. So I was willing to do that. But like you said, it was just too exhausting. Mm-hmm. And then I was just like, I had material and I was like, I'll make collages and Cintos and do whatever. Like it was just material to work with. And and then also to just get a sense of like how people were feeling. And what was just interesting was the ways in which our stories were so similar. Yeah. And it was like all of the absent fathers got the same memo. And that was like the tragic part about it is like, it is so stereotypical. It's just like, you just have to laugh at some point. But it also kind of there's this way of demystifying things where people, it's like, we all think, there's a quality of uniqueness to our stories, but there's something not original to our stories at the same time.
Yeah.
And once I realized that, I felt such a freedom. Like I don't have to worry myself with trying to be innovative or say something different. Like I can relax that and just sort of like sink into like my own personal metaphors and my own patterns and just like amplify them and blow them up and make new patterns from them. And that's going to be the interesting uniqueness that comes out of these universal experiences, is how I'm going to approach them with a kind of wholeness of myself versus coming at it in this fragmentary way, you know?
Oh my God, yes.
And So then I went to Guyana and I met my father, stayed in Georgetown, visited the place, mostly did a lot of walking about. The other interesting thing was like finding out that we were like staying in the exact town where he grew up.
Oh, really?
And so he like when we were walking to dinner or whatever, he would just point out like, oh, I would do that and over there, and that used to be a Capitol building and then wow. So we got a kind of mapping of the place based on his memories and shenanigans. I don't know, how do I get down this line? What am I talking about now? I totally lost my train of thought. But
no, it's fine. It's just so cool. I mean, he's such an interesting character too, that it's just like, it's fun to think about characters and like personas and things like that in a book of poetry. And I think again, it's just something to play and to just like amplify these different parts of ourselves that we want to explore, and our perceptions of the people who affect us in our life, and you know, through the play and poetry are able to make these discoveries and realizations and grow as people and become better writers and connect with other people. And like, you know, these three girls that make this documentary, like, just that the conversation keeps going and going, you know.
Exactly.
Here we're having this conversation, and that's just the best. That is why anyone should be doing poetry or writing books, you know. It's, you know, and for me, as you know, poetry being, you know, at the top, that I love that your dedication to keeping this poetry, you know, mm-hmm. even though it's memoir, even though, you know, it's written in often in prose, it never leaves that realm of poetry, and all the electricity and ambiguity that comes with that genre.
Yeah, I think at some point I decided, I was like, poetry is just gonna be at the center of everything.
Yeah.
It's gonna be at the center of how I write a critical paper. Like, I'm just gonna bring it everywhere, yeah, and sort of and feel and be shameless about it, you know? It's like
the only way sometimes, like, I could figure out how to do prose writing.
Yeah, same here. Yeah. Definitely. Like, I was like on a job interview, and someone asked me, like, how would I teach a sort of fiction workshop? And I was like, poetry.
I love it. So good.
It's like, we're going to like center poetry as a part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you get in to teach these classes, and people's idea of what poetry is like so sad and like flaccid and
so
like
true.
Boring and like and navel gazing, and it's like they're not having any fun with it at all.
I know, it's so true. It's like one of the best things I love teaching my students is like the movement in poetry. Mm-hmm. Matthew Zapruder has this great essay, and Why Poetry, Dream Meaning is the name of the essay. And he talks about that associative leaping that happens. And so once like the students notice that, the way the poem's turning and leaping and associating and finding resemblances, they get it. Like, their poems just have so much energy and electricity in it. And then they also realize that the poem is capable of pulling and holding so many things. Like, your attention doesn't need to just stay stuck.
I know. Like, there's like no opportunity is taken usually.
Yeah.
I'm like, you've basically done nothing in this entire book manuscript. You know, like, it's just like the same three words over and over again. And like, you can't get out of yourself. It's like, yeah, it's like, it is like you're kind of pulling things from around, like from the world. It's like, that's so great. Well, will you sing us out with a poem here? Maybe a short one, like the very last poem, maybe?
Okay. Yeah.
Or is that like...
No. The last one being On the Way to the Airport.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is when I realized, like, it was just something too, because this part came later when I realized, like, oh, this is... I'm sort of telling a love story, like almost like, yeah, two or three generations of love stories. And I was like, oh, that's how I close it out. And then I wrote the prologue. And then it's just interesting how like you present this book and it looks like it came in this order.
Yeah, I know. It's so true. And people who pick it up, they think that's how you wrote it. But it's, yeah, like, again, just to go back to like talking to people about their manuscripts, I'm like, you don't know what, once you are done with your manuscript, then you figure it out, like, mm-hmm, then you figure out what it's about and what you're doing. Reading this book, you said it exactly right. Like, I was like, oh my god, it turned into a love story, like so real. Like, I felt like so happy about that.
Yeah, so true. I was like, and then the section breakers with the Guyanese Proverbs, that's mm-hmm. when like I realized like, oh, this is how I can sort of temper the different kind of timelines in the book, you know, with this like the music of these proverbs, which interestingly was like the ones that like obviously the ones I picked, but it was just like so great how they wove into my story that I was telling. On the way to the airport, a sign announces the town of Pearl. I interlace my fingers with Monday ways, and I hold on to that feeling of and. A young man crosses the street with a cart full of pineapples. Once, and maybe somewhere still, seafaring men impaled fresh pineapples on their porch railings to let us all know that the man of the house has returned home. Come give him a visit. I remember my mother saying I was conceived in the back seat of Gerald's Cadillac, parked on Pineapple Avenue in Brooklyn Heights. The car perfectly suited his status, ice cream paint job and a cherry or two. Said he was too sweet and red Spanish pleasant. Gerald put the ladies' man charm in the jeans. After a long time away from his arms, he gave her a hospitable welcome, fresh I love yous, her path showered with rose petals, 4-star dinner, divine gentle mannery. She could not wait to get in the interior of his Cadillac, golden like a natal queen.
Mm. Risa White, thank you so much for talking to me today. I am, again, just madly in love with this book and everything that you're doing and thinking about.
Thank you so much. That was great to hear on a Sunday.